Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee. I'm a coach, speaker, and trainer. I'm the founder of the Evolution of Leaders. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, and behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. On this podcast, I interview Paris figure skating world and Olympic champion, Jamie Salle. Jamie reached the pinnacle of her sport, but it wasn't the easy path that many of us saw on TV. Most people don't know that she was ready to quit in 1998 until she was reunited with her partner, David Pelche. And then again, at the Olympics, it looked to the world they'd won the Olympic gold, but then there was a massive judging corruption scandal that denied them that opportunity. She got it later, but in this interview, she gives us a never-before-seen scoop about the corruption even before the Olympic Games. The most amazing insight for me is she's thought about stopping many times, but ultimately told herself she would never quit. She calls this the fire in her belly. I hope you enjoy this interview. Hello, everyone. This is Darwin with the Evolution of Leader Show, where I help people and teams grow and improve. My hope after listening to this podcast is that you will learn something about transformation, because today's guest is Jamie Salle. She is the world champion in Paris figure skating, along with Dave Pelletier. They're also in the Canadian Olympic Hall of Fame. In 2002 at the Olympic Games in Utah, they won the gold medal, becoming Olympic champions. She's also won Battle of the Blades and toured with Stars on Ice. Today, she runs a very successful life coaching business in Edmonton, Canada. Jamie Salle, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Darwin. It's great to be here.
And so as we lead off here, I'm wondering if you can give us just kind of a 60-second in your own voice, how you might describe your career.
Woo, we're starting off with a good one. Okay, so, well, because I would really honestly describe my career as a whirlwind. You know, I know some athletes, I know most athletes go through a lot of struggle and transformation in their life personally and in their career. But I went from, you know, moving cities while I was training to living with divorced parents to financial situations to, getting made fun of at school, to changing schools, to changing partners, and to almost quitting. And then again, you know, making it to the pinnacle of my career, which is the Olympic Games. So it was such a whirlwind of challenges and overcoming obstacles and adversity. And again, just all these words that we use for success, like persevering and everything. And so that's really what my career was all about. I didn't have things handed to me on a silver platter. Mm-hmm. And I had to work extremely hard, especially for my comeback with David. So, but I do feel grateful today that I did go through all of those other struggles, because I feel it's made me the person I am today.
And that's evident from the many interviews that I looked at coming into this. And one of the interesting things that I read about you in the great leadership magazine, Chatelaine, is that you didn't grow up in a household that was rich, and your mom spent, you know, like $250,000 on lessons. And so there's something that you did, some habit or behavior that you were able to use to allow you to become an Olympic champion. So if you can share a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because as a little girl, I used to have a very strong mindset. I was always, people would describe me as determined. But I think I was an old soul, and my mom used to cry herself to sleep many nights she suffered from depression. And so, which was challenging. It'd be challenging for anybody.
Yeah.
And I just remember always going to her and being a support for her and telling her everything was going to be okay. And yet she would get up every day and go to work so she could, you know, pay for my skating. And then I would have my own struggles outside at school, where people would make fun of me regularly, like whether it was my haircuts or my clothes, because I wasn't fashionable or I was doing really well in skating. So teachers would post up my articles, right? So there would be tacks in my eyes or scrapes through my pictures. And like, it was really hurtful, but I had an outlet, and my outlet was skating. And then because I was so passionate and enthusiastic about skating, I felt like that was my safe place. And I developed these habits around that. Like I really wanted it bad. It was my escape, I guess. And so I felt as long as I was achieving, I was thriving. And that way I could help support my mom, and I could get through you know, the school years of my life, because they were not easy growing up in Red Deer. But the habit for me was just positive self-talk, I would say, and really reinforcing that, you know, if you want this, this is what you have to do. So it's being consistent in always showing up every day. I talk to my clients about that all the time. Like, how do you show up today? And sometimes our best day is getting out of bed. You know, that the best we can do in a day is actually physically just getting out of bed, because we don't feel well. But, you know, I asked myself that daily. And there were days where I didn't want to be there because I was so sad, or I was injured, or something was wrong, right? And I would just be like, you have to make this your best day. You have to make this, just do the best you can with what you've got, with where you're at. That was the mindset I would say I always had. So I don't know how I learned that, Darwin, because I mean, my mom was very positive with me, even though she was struggling with depression. She was extremely positive with me, but I didn't have a mental coach back then that was like coaching me on how to think and how to talk and how to be. So, you know, and I work with adults right now who have children that are like this. It's rare. I will say it's rare where they're talking like this at like very young age. But it does exist in young kids too. So when your children are saying they're going to do something like big, believe them.
Yeah. That is fantastic advice for all parents out there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The theme of adversity kind of weaves in and out of your narrative through your life. And you had some success at Lillehammer in 94 with a top 20 finish, world championships. In the period between 94 and 98, though, between partners, you did some singles competition as well. There were some tough days, it seems like, in those years. And I'm wondering if you could tell us about that. There's an interesting quote in the Star here where you say, "But when I was doing singles, I was just not happy, really down in the dumps. Failure after failure after failure, nothing was working." And so how did you handle this? How did you get over that?
Yeah, that was a really tough time for me. Singles was not my passion. We all start off in singles in figure skating, and then we either get paired up, we continue singles, or we go into ice dance. Yeah. And once I started pairs, I knew that's what my ultimate passion was. Mm-hmm. And I loved flying through the air. I loved skating with a partner. But my relationship with my first partner ended, and I knew that there wasn't someone in the wings waiting to skate with me. So I was really quite sad, but I thought, okay, I've got this. And I sort of lived on, you know, that little success that I had had and being an Olympian for about a year. And then it kind of caught up to me and it bit me in the butt. And it was like, okay, but you can't just ride that. You actually have to put in the work, Jamie. And so the damage was already done. And I was already like, I didn't make it to nationals the year after. I started getting more serious about boys, you know, staying out later, not being disciplined.
Oh, yeah.
And that just took me right off track. And then finally my parents sat me down one day and they said, you know, something's got to change here. This is just not working out, because you either got to, like, you say you want this, but your actions aren't showing that. And so it was a simple discussion. It was like, you either shape up or ship out, right? Cause this is expensive. And it was a tough talk, but it was a great talk. And then the only other person that I remember at that time that really truly deep down, and I know that my skating coach believed in me, but, and he was always encouraging me, but there was one particular coach I had, and it was Jeff Crucial. He was my conditioning coach, and he was determined. He said, "Jamie, I am determined because I know that you want this really badly, that I'm going to get you there. Like, and I'm not doing the work. You have to do the work, but I want you to know, I believe in you more than you believe in yourself." And he kept just encouraging me daily. And again, it's got to come from within the person or the athlete, but it's really helpful when you're down in a gutter, when somebody constantly is there for you to tell you, "I believe in you and you're doing better than you think you are. And just keep going, because this is just what it looks like while you're working your way to your success." Like, it was hard, Darwin. Like, I remember days where I would get up and go, "Why am I even doing this? I am so far from my ultimate goal. Like, I'm not even close. And there's no sight of a partner for me." And I'm like, there were so many days where I was just like, "I'm wasting my time. I'm wasting my parents' money. What am I doing?" But then there was just this pit in my stomach, like a fire in the belly, that was saying, "You can't quit, Jamie. You're not done." And so that again was that habit of just reinforcing that those positive affirmations in my mind of like, there is greatness in you. You're capable. You are strong. You are determined. You are all these things. And if you, you know, I knew that if I did the work, I guess I didn't know, to be honest, like I say that, but it's like, I had faith. We always say, I hope things work out. I had faith that something good was going to happen. And before, it was 3 years went by, and I don't think many of people know this, but David and I actually did a tryout in 1996. Mm-hmm. And it was a really great tryout, but he was advised not to skate with me for whatever reason. I think there was it was just because he's from Quebec, I'm from Alberta. Sure, and I think there was just some jealousy. There was some kind of something going on there. And our tryout was amazing. And you can only imagine how good it was knowing how we skated together 2 years later. Right.
Yeah,
so it wasn't that it wasn't good. It was just, there was something weird. He was being advised to not skate with me. So I was quite devastated. So then that was exciting. So I peaked and then he said, sorry, I can't skate with you. And then I fell again. And so that's when Jeff came in to play for me even higher, even more. Like he was just there every day for me. And I was like, okay, so if I missed 2 years of nationals, and that's when everybody in Canada basically like wrote me off and not rudely. It's what happens in sport, sadly. Mm-hmm. You don't make it to nationals and you don't make it to a certain level, then it's like you're forgotten and people are moving on because the next guys are coming up. So, but I was like, I'm going back and I'm just going to be there because I want David to see me. So that's what happened. I got myself to nationals in 1998 and David saw me. I heard that he was quitting with his new partner. And actually I'd heard he was quitting in general. So I said, David, you cannot quit. I cornered him at nationals. I found him one day and I'm like, you can't quit. He's like, I'm not quitting. And I said, well, after we're done with all this, can we have a discussion? He's like, yes. So we had a discussion afterwards and I made him come out to Edmonton for a tryout. And I said, you know what, let's have a complete new start with a new coach. I'll move to Montreal because I know that's where I have to be. But yeah, but, so that's how that ended. But the darkest days were in those 3 years. It was like, if I think back to that, and I thought one day when I write a book about it, I probably will do quite a bit of crying, and not because, I'm sad about it today, but it's just like, it'll probably refresh a lot of the really hard days where I literally had to like grab my shirt and like take myself to the rink, you know? And just people that just said, Jamie, you should just quit. You know, you're pretty done. And just, yeah, it was just a really not, enjoyable time for me. And so everybody knows when you're not doing what you love, then it's, like when you're doing a job that you don't love, it can be even torturous at times, and it's really hard to show up and be your best version of yourself. And that's what I was experiencing.
Sometimes the pain that comes with transformation is hard, but if we get through it, it says something about us. And, and then moving forward, you and David become, improve very quickly. And there's an interesting aspect to the way that, you know, you as a pair kind of improved and climbed the rankings. The Russians had dominated for about four decades, and you and David then go on to win a world championship, and you're considered probably, you know, amongst many, maybe one of the favorites headed into the Utah Olympics. Now, I've always found it interesting when someone does something for the first time. It seems like there's something different about like a pioneer or a trailblazer. Mm-hmm. And so you're doing this, you know, for the first time with few, you know, modern role models at the time of Canadians who might have, you know, gotten gold. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, how did you forge that path in the absence of a direct role model, of a clear path in front of you? How did you do that?
Oh, wow. You have good questions.
I appreciate that. You have good answers, and that's what counts.
Well, thank you. I think as a little girl, I'll go back to when I was watching the 88 Olympics when I was 11, and I watched Elizabeth Manley finish her program. And, said to my mom, I'm going there. That's where I want to be. I want to be on television like that. I want to go to the Olympics. And I just remember feeling the energy, because I was growing up in Red Deer and it was in Calgary, and we could literally feel that energy. And I wanted that so bad. And so then when I got a little bit older and I got into pairs, I wanted to be like Isabelle Brasseur. And there was like a few other pair girls that I wanted to emulate and be like. And then of course I found out, way before us was Barb Underhill and Paul Martini.
Yeah.
And then I eventually got to work with her and I was just like starstruck and just so, I want to be like you. And they weren't gold medalists at the Olympics, but they were gold medal people to me. And so I used them as inspiration and athletes that I wanted to think like and train like and perform like, because they were so powerful. Like there was Isabelle and Lloyd were always, everybody just watched them with like, they were just so dynamic. They had great tricks. And then Barb and Paul were so fast and strong and powerful. And I was just like, yes. So they were my role models with the way that they handled themselves and the way they competed and the way they spoke and the way they trained. But then it came from within me. I remember training with David in Montreal and we had there were four other pair teams on the ice when we were training. And people used to interview us and say, not that the people we were skating with weren't good. We were Canadian champions. And so we were the best at our training center. And people used to say to us, well, don't you have to train at places where everybody's like, people are better than you so that they're pushing you. And we said, if you need people to push you, then you might as well like, you know, push you to motivate you. You might as well throw in the towel.
Uh-huh.
And, pushing you is good, but to be motivated, like David and I woke up every day motivated.
Yeah.
We were motivated to be the best in the world. So we would watch the Russians, we would watch the Chinese, and we were like, what are they doing? And we're going to do that and some, because we knew we had to beat them. And I mean, the Chinese were doing quad throws. The Russians were always so fluid and effortless and beautiful. And as you said, they were dominating. And so we're like, how can we beat them? So we just knew that we had to do what we were doing plus or times five, even like just more of it. And so that's what we did, but we never used our training facility as like, we got to be in the best place where there's, you know, the Russians are training or the Chinese are training so that we can be motivated. Mm-mm. Motivation came from within us. And it was just entirely all about wanting to be the best in the world. And what do we need to do that?
Yeah. Sometimes people describe it as process versus outcome. And it seems like that's the path that you walked. Just focus on the process.
Everything
getting
is
better.
A process.
Yeah.
Forgiveness is a process. Achieving is a process. Mm-hmm. Transformation is a process. Everything we go through, it's all a process. We're still living, right? You know, we started and we're going to end. And in the middle in that is always a process. So yeah. And it depends on what that process looks like for you. Sometimes it's really awesome and sometimes it's downright ugly. So, and I think it's all, you know, it makes you who you are today. We all wish sometimes we could go back and do things differently, but if we knew better, we would have done better. So I always tell people, don't beat yourself up on what coulda, shoulda, you know, we shoulda, coulda, woulda, mm-hmm. right? Or I wish I would have done that differently. Well, you did the best you could do at that time with what you knew. And so it made you the person who you are today. And so actually for that, have gratitude, be grateful. You know, even if you're in a bad spot in your life and you're now speaking up to somebody, just be grateful that you had the awareness to start speaking up about it. That's how I see it.
And, you know, speaking of changes and making improvements and learning lessons, you go from the Olympics in 94 as wow, you're young as a 16-year-old. There's a story about you doing homework in the Olympic Village. In 98, you're maybe not competing at Nagano, but then in 2002, you're in Utah. You're a more mature skater. You've been through quite a bit. You're with David now, and you got a world championship under your belt. What changes, what improvements did you take and lessons from 94 to 2002? What are some of the things that you change that really help you to compete and to win ultimately?
Well, in those years, those were my dark times. So I went through, like we talked about already, the process and the journey was not easy for me. So what I learned I had to change was my training habits. Again, I always had deep down the ability to use self-positive talk. I had the ability. I didn't do it every day, but I always would like pull myself out somehow. But it was what I was doing training wise. I had to learn that it's not always about quantity, it's about quality. And so that's where my conditioning coach came into play. It was like, you're not just going to go in the gym and spend 2 hours in the gym and say you worked out for 2 hours. You might have to go in here today for 22 minutes and it's going to be super specific. And these are the exercises you're going to do and you're going to walk out. You're done. You don't hang around. You don't like chit chat. You don't get involved with toxic conversations. You do your work. It's a business. And so I had to really see training as in a different way. It was like kind of the way you would go to a job, right? Where you're like, you show up, you punch in, you punch out. And then he said to me, and even when you leave the rink, who you're spending time, you're eating, like what you're watching on television, that impacts you physically and mentally. I want you to really consider that. So that was something actually that I took with me when I started, when we were training for the Olympics. I said to Dave, I remember when I was trying to have in my singles career, these were the things that I had to change. And I said, I really think we need to consider this with leading up to the Olympics. And there were people that thought we were weird. There were people that family members were like, because we didn't want to be around certain people in our family because they're not necessarily the most positive people, or they like to gossip or whatever, right? So we said, we don't want to be around that. It's heavy. It's toxic. It's not healthy for us. We had strict diet. I know everybody's like, well, that's no fun. Well, you know what? We had to treat our bodies like a lean, mean fighting machine. The only way to do that is to feed it with proper nutrition. It wasn't eating cake and drinking alcohol, you know? So we knew that that was the process for that year. And that was what was really important. And once we were done, then we can celebrate with those things. But it's kind of like, for us, it was worth it to have to go through all that to have the end result, because we knew that when we got to the Olympics that we didn't want to have anything. I want to be able to look at each other and go, we should have done this, that extra run through, we should have eaten better. I should have lost an extra pound or like any of that. We just said, let's just do everything we can to be our absolute best. So it was really the biggest change would have been, to answer your question again, is just the way I was training. And actually mapping it out. My whole life, I've always written my goals out and I've spoken where I'm going and I've been very clear on that, but we had to get very specific. Like it was literally daily goals, weekly goals. And we were journaling.
A lot of discipline. Yeah. There's a fascinating kind of inflection point at the 2002 Olympic Games. And most people think that as a result of your skate that you and David, probably had just won the gold, but it didn't come across that way. And one of the judges, Marie-Reine Lagogne, and I apologize, I'm probably butchering that, but interestingly, Wikipedia says that she's now known as the French judge.
Yeah, the French judge.
Yeah, gave a score that later came out to have some controversy. Go ahead.
So the whole part of this that I don't love is that she's the only one that's talked about. So if you really look at figure skating and that night, we had nine judges. Okay. Yeah. And there were five of them that had a second. And so, I know you'll find this fascinating it's funny because I don't know why we didn't notice this. There were five that had a second and four that had us first. She was the one that, and we know this now, that told our judge, the Canadian judge, back in November, that this was going to be a tough Olympics for her because she really liked the Canadian team, and she liked Benoit, our judge, but she has to put the Russians first.
This is before.
Remember, this is in before the Olympics. This is in November. Yes.
Wow.
So she's telling him at a competition that she can't put us first. She feels really bad. And he's standing with his jaw dropped going, what did you just say? And so he decided to keep his mouth shut about it and just go to the Olympics, hoping that he could make change. He could fix it. And so when the whole thing played out and we ended up being the better team that night, he sort of grabbed her shoulder when she was trying to leave for the medal ceremony. And he said, you sit and watch what you just did. And I think that's really what hit her. So she ended up going back to the hotel. Out of the five judges, she went back to the hotel and all her colleagues were looking at her going, what just happened to me? This is not good. And she broke down and she said, I've been told, you know, and she just shared everything she was supposed to do. Yeah. But in that, they call it a collusion, those four other judges aren't mentioned. So there's China, there was Russia, because we didn't realize there was a Russian judge, but there was. And there were two other ones, and I can't remember. But so they got those guys all together to help support her as well. So yeah, it's not just the French judge, but she's the one that was exposed because she spoke up. So in some ways, I know everybody thinks this is funny, but Dave and I thank her. Skating thanks her. Everybody thanks her because she's the one that actually spoke out. If she wouldn't have said anything, this thing would have been like, you know, just not, it would have been, the US was not okay with it. The people and the media were outraged, but I don't know what would have come of it if she didn't actually say something. I am not sure.
Wow.
I know. It's deeper than most people know. And yeah, so we have a documentary coming out this fall, hopefully. It was supposed to be this summer, and I think it's going to be in the fall now. We're part of a series of documentaries about scandal. And I think there's going to be a lot more exposed in that, because a lot of the public really only knows just a very small portion of what happened. And there was so much more that went on behind the scenes, like with mafia stuff, like mob stuff. And it's complicated. Dave and I remember at the time, even in August after the Olympics, we had a golf tournament, and the media shows up and they're like, all this stuff is happening. And the Russian ice dance girl was talking with the Russian mob and blah, 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 blah. And we're sitting there going, what? Like, our heads were spinning because we had no idea.
We're athletes. Yeah.
And you're talking about the Russian mob now and phone calls and this person and money here and that, and someone's died now. Like, we're going, okay, we're out. Like, we just, you know what? We skated really great. We're just happy to be, you know, we're happy. Like, we're out. Yeah. It's bananas. It's really bananas.
So this is why, the CIA was partially assigned to protect you.
Protect us. And we didn't know they were protecting us. Like, that's another thing that was so weird for me to hear afterwards. You know, our chef de mission told us later, a long time later, like, about that they were following us everywhere. And I actually said, that's actually really scary. She's like, well, we had to, because we knew that there were a lot of unhappy people and we didn't want to take any risks. And the Americans told us we should do this. Oh, I have goosebumps talking about it right now. Like, you don't grow up in Canada worrying about that stuff.
Not at all. I don't believe this has come out before, to my knowledge.
No.
Well, we look forward to the documentary for sure.
Yeah,
and
good.
You know, 2 days after you won, my family and I were standing in line behind you at a concession stand. And I know now we were probably surrounded by the CIA and not knowing it, but
yeah, they were undercover.
Things were crazy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The way that you handled it, I felt, was really indicative of a phrase, control what you can control. And mm-hmm. I'm just going to share a brief clip. This is from an interview, a clip from the interview with Larry King.
Okay.
And
Larry, that was so funny.
Yeah.
That was the best interview.
Great interview. And you're back being interviewed there. And the interesting thing is, you didn't attempt it. We could see it was disappointing. We could see it was frustrating. And yet both yourself and David, you never really lashed out at anyone, got angry ever. No. How did you go forward? And, you know, you talk about, you know, from a little girl, you'd wanted to be an Olympic champion, and that, that your dream was kind of thwarted. So, and yet you're treating it with so much class. What did that look like? What was your conscious decision at the time?
Well, you talk about a process for transformation. I went through a very fast one, because you could see right after we got our results, I was in shock and immediately disappointed, to going to have to talk to the press right away backstage, to crying and feeling sorry for myself and for David, like, just total victim state. You know, because I felt like we've worked our whole lives for this moment, and you've just taken that away from us, right? Because of, like, I knew deep down in my gut, there was something that was going on. Like, oh, they're, you know, because the Russians always win, so here we go again, right? But it wasn't their night. And I can actually honestly say that with strength right now. And I know that there are fans of the Russians. Trust everybody that is a Russian fan. I'm a fan of them. I love them. I love watching them skate. But they weren't the better team that night. Now, they would still argue that. But the fact is, their elements weren't as strong as they normally can do them. So anyway, then I had to go out to get my medal, and I had to show that I was being mature and I wasn't going to take away from their moment. And I've always been that way. Like, I'm a good loser. Like, I know that I don't like losing, but it's important to show and give credit to the people who are better than you on that night. I always say that may the best man win. And if they got that award that night, I might not agree with it, but I'm going to stand here with my head high and I'm going to congratulate them and the Chinese team and just be gracious. And so that was hard, but it was also just what that's my operating system. That's just the way I am. So I got off the podium and I remember we skated over to the CBC booth where they were, and the French CBC guys came down and they right away told David that there was a scandal. And so Dave's trying to quickly tell me what they're saying in French. And I'm like, what?
Oh, right. What?
We went from shock to sadness to anger to going to Canada House, walking in that night late for the whole room to sing O Canada for us at like midnight, to overwhelm joy, to the next morning waking up going, this is going to be a story. And we were told right away, watch out, like this is going to blow up. No, and before we even heard about the French judge speaking, we just knew that being in America, that there were so many people that weren't okay with this, that it was just going to be wildfire. And NBC was talking about it. Like they said, you guys, this is going to be, it's just going to blow up. And so we kind of sat back and more of like, okay, let's just be gracious and be proud because we came here to do our job and we did the best we could. And let's just be kind. And it wasn't much of a conversation, but that's just sort of how I think a lot of Canadians are. And that's why we're liked and appreciated around the world when we travel. But we went back to why we went there and we said, you know, we came here to do this and we did it. So let's just keep talking about that. We haven't bad to say about anybody else that we competed against or any of the judges, even though, you know, we're disappointed, but let's just talk about our skate. That's it. So again, back to your point, control what you can control. We controlled our skating and now we can control what we're going to say. And we just choose to talk about the good.
Well, many Canadians appreciated how classy you were, and felt that you presented a good kind of face for all Canadians.
Thank you.
And so moving forward with the lessons that you learned, you start a very successful life mastery coaching career, and that's what you're doing right now and helping to perpetuate transformation. That's my phrase, not yours, but I'd be curious to see how you might describe kind of what you're doing today and how you're giving back and in some of your work with the Special Olympics.
Oh, and Special Olympics. Well, I can start with that. So I've been working with Special Olympic athletes involved with the movement for over 8 years now. I first was invited to an event and from that day on, I was hooked. I was just so... I was just obsessed with the way I felt. I wanted more of it when I would be around these athletes. And I realized what it was that, they brought me back to why I started skating. And that was because, I truly loved it. It was just a passion of mine at a very young age. And these athletes are so grateful just to be there. And they're so happy to do what they love. And they're so excited to share it with each other, even though they're competing against each other. And there are some of them that really are there to win too. But I just love the camaraderie and I love the joy and the energy that they had and they exuded. And so I ended up being a board and then I got up on the national board and now I'm just continuing on to be a part of the movement and supporting them, raising money and doing fundraisers and things like that. And, I stay very connected. I just feel like I can't imagine my life without being connected to Special Olympic athletes. It was interesting, Darwin, when I was a little girl, I always told my mom I wanted to work with, she had a family friend that had Down syndrome and he was deaf and I just loved him. I always wanted to be around him. And, I get emotional about it because he was so incredibly special. He's gone now, but, I always said, mom, work with people like him. And I didn't understand because I was like 8 years old. I didn't understand like what he had or what was wrong with him or whatever. I just knew that he was different. But I loved him. And I told my mom, I said, I really want to work with people like that. And so we later on in life, she was like, well, he has Down syndrome and this is what it is. And I just said, well, mom, there's something about them that I'm so attracted to. I think, you know, they're so enjoyable and they have so much life in them. And they're just, I don't even know how to describe it. So here I found myself, you know, getting invited. So it's interesting how you put stuff out in the universe, right? So then years later, now I'm able to give back and do other things that I love. And I get invited to a Special Olympic event. And yes, they don't all have Down syndrome, but I was just like, well, here I am now serving another purpose of mine. Right. And I'm like, I just love this. So, I'm super passionate about it. I can't imagine my life without it.
Yeah.
And one of the other things that happened was 3 years after I retired, I found myself, you know, I looked around, and I have everything I've ever dreamed of and some, but I found myself, and the word I used was pissy. I was really irritable and I was just like grouchy and I was like, oh, what's wrong with me? So I went and as I've always done my whole life, when I'm struggling, I go get help, you know, whether it's psychology or it's just a mentor or something. And so I reached out to somebody that I had met at a yoga retreat and she was a life coach. And I said, I don't know what's wrong with me. And I gave her all my conditions and told her all my problems. And she's like, you've stopped dreaming. You know, are you writing your goals out anymore? Do you have a vision of where you want to be? And I said, mm-hmm. No, because mm-hmm. I've already achieved my dream. She's like, but you're not done living. So why did you stop dreaming? And I said, oh shoot, that's a good point. So I said, I don't know what I want to do though. She goes, just write what you do know. And so I wrote down help people. And all it's interesting too that I wrote that because I didn't have any other, like any background to go into, like my mom's an interior designer, I didn't have a desire to go into be a doctor. I mean, I did consider nurse. I do love doing surgery, but I just knew I've always liked helping people. So even though I had struggles in my life, when somebody else was struggling, I was always there to help them. Like I go back to even my childhood with my mom and how I coddling her and telling her, like supporting her. And so I stuck those two words in my career part of my paper. And it was 2 weeks later, I was shocked and I was sitting there going, this is exactly what I'm going to be doing. And so now what I do is exactly what I've just been explaining. I help people like me that, and other people that haven't necessarily had great success. Some people, I have clients that of all ranges and all kinds, who have had great success, but want to figure out their greater purpose or, you know, that they've been doing something successfully, but it's not truly what they love. Or I've had people that are really down in rock bottom and they don't know what to do. So they want to learn the mindset. They want to learn that training that we talked about. They want to learn how do you overcome all this? So that's what I do with my clients. I coach them through, I get them right away. We create a vision of what a life they would love living. Because often Darwin, what we do is, and I was doing the same thing. We base our visions or our dreams on what we think we can do or what our family thinks we're capable of or what our environment says we can do or the economy says we can do. I mean, shoot, if we all made visions based on what the economy says right now, we wouldn't be big dreamers, right? So the important thing that I get everybody to do through a process that I get them into is not allowing our conditions or our circumstances to dictate what our actual vision, long-term vision is. Yes, we're going to be in a pandemic for the next while. I don't know how long, but it could be a year. It could be two more years. We don't know. And so you can still have a long-term vision, but in these 2 years, it's now you say, what can I do with what I've got with where I'm at? And so I love coaching because I'm enthusiastic. I'm really passionate about it. I've been through a lot, so I'm super vulnerable and relatable with clients. And I think they really appreciate that and respect that very much because they look at me like I'm, you know, like you've said, Olympic gold medalist, a champion, a superstar, whatever word they see me as. And yet when I tell them about my struggles, they're like, that happened to you and you went through that. And yet you came through on the other side. I said, yes, I'm not special. You know, we're all of us have incredible power inside of us. And I said, the one thing that I didn't do that others do is quit. I said, I just didn't quit. And I said, I had many reasons to quit. I had many conditions that told me to quit. I had all kinds of thoughts in my head, give it up, throw in the towel, you're done, you're old, you're no good anymore. But I didn't quit because I truly believed deep down inside of me that where I was going, like where I wanted to be was possible. So getting people out of the mindset of why it can't happen, why it's not possible, what problems are going to come from that. I get them in a different mindset of thinking like, what if it did happen? What would that feel like? You know, it's just a completely different way of thinking. I get it every day. Well, that can't happen. Why? Like I said, you know what? These things that we talk on every day, that wasn't possible either 40 years ago, right? You think about it, computers, was that possible? Mm-hmm. How many years ago? Thomas Edison was told he was insane because he was working on electricity. Now we flick a switch like it's not a big deal. Flying airplanes, that was insanity. You're not going to put something in the air and put people in there. Are you crazy? Right? So it's so much fun to get people out of their limited thinking states and get them thinking so much more positively and thinking about opportunities and possibilities. And then they start thriving. Like I totally love what I do.
You know, what's better than transformation, Jamie, is facilitating transformation in others.
Yes.
And what you're doing Powerful. Is amazing. I wish you all the best with your life mastery coaching and bringing about transformation and bringing the change that we need so much in the world today, Jamie.
Thank you, Darwin. This was like honestly a very insightful interview for me. You asked wonderful questions, and I'm grateful to have this time with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much for listening and viewing. If you want to learn more about this topic or others, go to my website, evolutionofleaders.com. Make sure you get 1% better today and tune in again on a future episode of The Evolution of Leaders. Thank you for listening and watching. I hope you enjoyed this interview. What struck me is her amazing ability to positively self-talk into achieving amazing things, how her coach Jeff Crichel saw hidden potential inside of her even when she didn't, and ultimately she just never quits, never does. And she's got a gold medal at the Olympics to show for that, and that's so awesome. And then the scoop, the crutch judging even before the Olympics, robbing them of the gold, although they did get that subsequently. But man, what a story there. And then going forward through life, thinking she'd achieve the pinnacle, and then realizing that you still need to set goals even after, you know, you reach the ones that you set, and how she transitioned into coaching and all the wonderful things she's done in that arena now. I am a leadership and career coach. Go to my website if you'd like to touch base. Would love to hear from you. If you enjoyed this, would love it if you liked and shared. I appreciate that so much, and I love engaging with my audience that way. Thank you so much.